Welcome to Science with Samantha. I'm an electrical engineering student who is curious about many science-related subjects and wants to discuss it with experts. The guest of this episode is Dr. Sandra Brunken, an assistant professor of the Felix Institute at Radboud University in Nijmegen. She's had major contribution in her research fields, which are astrochemistry and astrophysics, with the Nature publication under her name. Now she's at the Free Electron Laser Institute called Felix to continue her research. So to start with, thank you for wanting to join our episode with me. And
of course,
could you give an introduction of yourself to the audience?
Yes, I'm happy to do so. So you already say, my name is Sandra Brunken. And since around 4 years, I'm now an assistant professor here at the Felix Laboratory and at Radboud. And I'm actually a physicist by training, so I studied physics in Bonn, St. Andrews in Berlin. And I was, well, actually in my master's thesis, I worked in a little bit different field. I was more atomic physics. But I was throughout all my studies very much interested in astronomy. And then towards the end of my studies, I actually heard a very interesting talk by Pascal Ehrenfreund, who was until recently the director of the German Space Institute. And she worked in astrobiology, and she introduced me to this field of laboratory astrophysics, so that you actually can do experiments for understanding processes in space. And I found this very fascinating, because I like to do things in the lab, and I liked astrophysics, but I didn't want to be what we call an armchair astronomer. So I like this. So because of this, I then decided to do my PhD in Cologne, where there was a, or is still a very prominent group in laboratory astrophysics. And so there I focused on spectroscopy, so that is taking, you know, absorption spectra of molecules. That was more in the terahertz to actually down to radio wavelength, in order to get fingerprints of these molecules and then to try to identify them in space. And it was a very nice combination, so it was a lot of laboratory work. But also I started with really doing astronomical observations myself to some extent. And then I continued with this during a postdoc at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where actually the part of the astronomy became even a little bit bigger. And that was all very interesting. But at some point, well, the spectroscopy was not really enough for me anymore, because what you can do is I can maybe get back to this later, but it's really to identify new species in the laboratory and then find them in space. But that's not the whole story, because you also would like to understand how they come about. So how are they formed? How are they destroyed? Why are they there? Why are some not there? Why are some there? So I wanted to look more in this chemistry aspect, into the kinetics, into the reaction chemistry of these species. And so that's why I then had a quick stop in at the EPFL in Lausanne before I then went actually back to Cologne for another postdoc, and then later also started a bit of my own research group. And there I had really the pleasure actually to work with really experts in on building and maintaining and running what's called cryogenic ion trap instruments, about, I guess, we talk a little bit later, which allows us really to do a lot of, again, spectroscopy, but with a bit different methods, but also to look at chemical processes and allowing to manipulate these ions. And this was all very interesting, and actually one of these instruments that I was had the pleasure to help building was transferred then here to the Felix Laboratory already at the end of 2014. It's already a while ago.
Back then you were in part of Felix, right?
No, back then I was still in Cologne. But then we came here for scientific missions, so always like 2-3 weeks to actually use then this instrument together with our lasers here, the free electron lasers at Felix. And that was actually a lot of fun, and we did a lot of nice science. And then, a couple of years later, there was this chance here about the Christine Moormann program, where it's a, it's a fellowship for female scientists to actually start a tenure track position here, at the Faculty of Science.
Amazing.
And then I applied for this. It was actually quite a tough competition, but I made it, so I was very happy. And then I decided to come here to Felix to really continue my work here, and also to branch out into a little bit different fields. And that it was sad to leave Cologne, because there was also a nice group, but here it's a really very pleasant environment also to work and to continue.
So So how long were you at Cologne then?
Well, that was basically then, well, the PhD was around 4 years, but then when I came back, that was another 9 years. So it was a quite long postdoc. Yeah. So, because I always like to do what is fun, and I didn't care too much about about the next steps, maybe. But we did a lot of really interesting projects there, and we really built the instrument that's now also here and that we're using now here. So that was a quite long time, but also a lot of things learned there.
And what are now at Felix? What does Felix expand you to do now? Did it like influence your current interest right now? Maybe?
It did change it a little bit, yes, I must say. So I'm still I'm not sure, maybe I should explain a little bit what my research field is before. Because what we are interested in is say that it's laboratory astrophysics, mm-hmm. but it's basically what we want to understand in the end are processes in what is called interstellar medium. So that's not looking really at stars, but it's looking at the space between the stars, which is filled.
Could it be also the clouds that form the stars?
Exactly. So a lot is happening in these so-called molecular clouds. So these are really vast amounts of gas and dust, and these are actually the building sites then of new stars and also the planets. And a lot of chemistry is actually going on in there. So a lot of more than 100 of different molecular species have been found. So it's far from empty. It's very dilute. It's very cold. But there is a lot of interesting things happening. And this, of course, all influences also then the formation of the stars. So these molecules are basically the raw material from which the stars form. But also we can use these molecular lines or absorption lines, emission lines that we can pick up with telescopes to understand something about the physical conditions, right? So how much infall do we have? What is the time scale, for example, for the star formation? So we use these molecules as a probe. And the thing is, what I had done so far was a lot of doing spectroscopy, really finding this fingerprint of molecules, then writing a proposal for a telescope, going to that telescope, finding these molecules. And the more you dig into this, you understand also that they say that you want to understand how this comes about. And this is what I do now a lot here at Felix, that we look at actually chemistry, at kinetics. And we can do this in the instrument that we have, but we use then the Felix laser to actually do spectroscopy still. But we use this spectroscopy now to learn about the structure of the molecules we have. So it's maybe as an example, let's assume we start with some molecule that reacts, or an ion in our case that reacts with something, and then it forms another molecule. And you can do a lot with more standard methods like mass spectroscopy, where you see that, okay, you start with one mass and you add something, you end up with a higher mass. But you don't know what is actually formed. So the structure of the product you have. And of course, it's quite important, right? Because if you have a different structure of a molecule, it has a different function. It is a completely different molecule. So with the laser, we can actually pick up on or investigate the structure by taking the spectrum compared to calculations. And then we know exactly, okay, we're forming this molecule and not the other one. Or we're forming both. And we can then learn very in-depth about the chemistry that's happening.
So if I understand, you shifted from just looking for a new molecule, finding the composite of the cloud, now to the actually processes that are happening in the cloud.
That is a good summary of it.
So I wonder, is there still a lot of unknown particles in the cloud to be found? Is that still...
That's what we think, yes. So it's, of course, with the advent of all these new telescopes, so we have in the last years there was the ALMA interferometer, which has a very high sensitivity. They're very large radio telescopes, more in the lower frequency range. And now just at Christmas, the JWST, James Webb launched. And all these telescopes, they get better and better, meaning they have more resolution in the sense that they can maybe distinguish more on spatial scales and spectral scales, but they're also more sensitive. So they allow us to look deeper and deeper into these regions. And what is often that, of course, the molecules that have been found now, they're often very strong. Well, there's a lot of them, so they absorb very strongly. Uh-huh. But they are, the interest is going towards more and more complex species. I mean, that's one of the big questions in astrochemistry. So how do you come from small, I mean, from atoms first that are produced in the stars, then to the small molecules like hydrogen and then CO, to larger and larger ones. What we are interested in is a lot is these so-called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are kind of fused benzene rings that can get larger and larger. Or the buckyballs, they're related to this. And these are the first steps also to like dust formation. Yeah. And then this could be even larger species. And at some point they might agglomerate to a planet, right? Or a star. And, the other, direction is it always sounds very big, but it's this kind of origin of life. So there is a lot of interest in trying to understand how in these molecular clouds maybe rather complex prebiotic, let's call them, molecules exist. So if you can form the first amino acids, if you can form the first sugars maybe, if under the conditions in these clouds, this could already have happened. So this is the other branch. And then the larger the molecules are, the more difficult it's basically to observe them because they typically are weaker. So there's less of them and they don't absorb so much or emit so much radiation.
And then, so if you mean that like doesn't absorb that much, you see like the fingerprint doesn't have as high peaks.
Yes. Spectrum, right? So basically it's, the intensity. So I mean, you can, these telescopes, they're super sensitive. So you pick up tiny amounts of radiation. I mean, I had
that's
once this
rough, right? Because how can you differentiate it from the noise then?
Yes, that is the thing. Oh. So the better the telescopes are or the longer you can integrate also, the lower the noise gets, and then you can see more other features that are actually real. And then by comparing this to the laboratory work, you can then actually pick them out from the other noise or from the other things. So there has actually been especially in the last year, due to a lot of very sensitive observations, been a really tremendous amount of new species even found. So typically we have something like, let's say, 5 new species per year. Mm-hmm. That was, but I think alone in the last year it was 20.
Amazing.
And also really large ones. So that was quite an exciting time. And then of course you need to understand, why this and so why is it there?
Why? How is it formed like
yes.
that? Right.
Yeah. Okay. That is what we are a lot interested in. Mm-hmm.
So, to go all the way back, what inspired you to study physics and then later branch out to the spectroscopy with the astrochemical?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, the thing is with physics, I mean, I was always interested in it. I mean, of course, as a kid, you have a lot of things, but I really like that you can have mathematical tools describe part of reality. Yeah. So that fascinated me, and I wanted to get a little bit into this. So but on the other hand, I mean, it's a very large field, and I don't know if I need to motivate interest in astronomy, because I think everybody is a little bit fascinated. So as I said before, this kind of combination then of this laboratory experimental work with astrophysics that really intrigued me. So I never wanted to be this kind of armchair astronomer. I mean, there are a lot of great astronomers out there, but what I really like.
You wanted more hands-on, right?
Yes, I like this hands-on attitude that you have really something that you can do in the laboratory that you can manipulate, where you can turn some knobs. But then, in the view of having then this work, standing often also for itself, because it's really, I mean, it's molecular physics, or chemistry, or spectroscopy, but you use it then to explain something that's light years away. And I found it always very, really satisfying if you are in your basement laboratory, figuring something out and go to the telescope and see the same things really, somewhere in a molecular cloud. So basically, we do really, let's say, microscopic physics here, really working with tiny molecules. But in the end, we want to understand really macroscopic processes, like how these kind of, star-forming regions, behave, how stars are formed. We also look now or have projects that are more related to, for example, planetary atmospheres like Titan, Saturn's moon, where there's also the question where is all this thick haze coming from?
Yeah.
And then so we try to devise experiments, of course, a little bit pinpoint to find some of these important reactions that might happen under these conditions.
I wonder, so do you know the composite of the gases, for example, at Jupiter, and what's happening at Titan with the... Titan is a super cold planet, right? Or no?
Yeah, well, it's the atmosphere, yeah. It can go down to 150K or so. That's true, yeah. So it's more methane than water. That's the liquid on the surface.
But
yes.
We are aware of what is about the composite.
Well, there's always new data coming in. So for Titan, it's actually a lot known because there was this very famous Cassini-Huygens mission.
Oh.
A couple of years ago,
uh-huh.
where they actually not only used the light, you know, spectroscopy, mm-hmm. but they actually really had a probe that really sampled the atmosphere with a mass spectrometer.
Okay.
And there were still, I mean, that was ended 13 years ago or so, the mission, but there was so much new information.
Uh-huh.
So they found, for example, that you have ions there, so negatively charged molecules, cations, and they found a lot of... Actually, they're rather complex molecules. They're hydrocarbons and nitriles.
Wow.
And that was a bit of a surprise to understand how this comes about.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of data, but there's always the hope for more data. The more you know, the more you want to know. But
a lot of data, but still not enough.
Yeah, and of course, for other planets, it's similar. I mean,
mm-hmm.
the closer they are, the easier it is. So there are a lot
mm-hmm.
of Mars missions, as you know.
Yeah.
There'll be Venus mission and...
Mars is probably the planet we know the most about,
yes,
right now.
Yes, I would think so. Yes,
yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, this is also related then to understand exoplanetary atmospheres at some point, because these are the closer planets we have, and then the more you know about these different types of planets,
mm-hmm.
planetary atmospheres, then you can transfer them, hopefully, to understand also atmospheres of exoplanets at some point.
It would be interesting to know more about Venus, indeed. Venus is such a the greenhouse gases there are a lot there, right? And I heard that it's very extreme down there, and there's a lot of the atmosphere is also really interesting, I believe, the composite. So
really, because there's such a large amount of CO2 in the atmosphere that then
CO2.
You basically I'm not a super expert on this
mm-hmm.
field, so I'm more still on the interstellar medium, but it's really that it's believed that this was kind of a runaway greenhouse effect at some point.
Yeah.
And that then heated mm-hmm. up the surface so much more than you would expect just from the, you know, sunlight
mm-hmm.
coming in. So it's a very thick, very dense atmosphere and a lot of CO2 in there.
Yeah, interesting. And then so it's very interdisciplinary, if I think about it, because you have to map micro scales, for example, to what's happening on the macro scale, but also you have to know chemistry, but then you then have to relate it back to physics, what is happening out there. So you have a physics background, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you start picking up more of the chemistry side of this?
Yeah, that's again a very good question. So I of course, I mean, I had a very good basis from my studies. But to be honest, I mean, I had a lot of astronomy courses, but I never had a single chemistry course during my studies for whatever reason. So for me, that was, I was always a bit worried too. But so it's a lot of learning on the job, actually.
Mm.
So once you dive into the field, I mean, it's of course sitting down, sometimes really with a textbook again to learn. But I must say, especially in our field, it's very much based on collaborations also. So, for example, often team up with real, let's say, astronomers
mm-hmm.
and kind of people who model the molecular clouds or the atmospheres. And in that sense, you learn also, of course, a lot by just working with these people
mm-hmm.
who are very knowledgeable about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the bigger thing. So you go to conferences, meetings, and if there's something interesting, you dig a little bit deeper, you read up on it, you try to learn new methods. I mean, it's really continuous learning, I mean, which is actually very nice. So it's not that at some point you have all the knowledge and you stop there and just apply it. So that's how it should be.
It wouldn't be exciting anymore then.
No.
You already knew everything.
And I must really also admit, at the moment, I'm also learning from my students, right?
Mm.
So our team is really also composed of chemists and physicists and our science students. and a lot have, you know, a lot of experience also with calculations, for example. So that's something that I haven't done so much myself. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because they then teach me sometimes how to do it. So I really liked it. It's a very great team. And
is it more like processing of the information, that kind of calculation of data processing?
It's both things. So we often, what we get from the laboratory is, in the very simple case, it's a spectrum. So we get a kind of absorption spectrum where a specific molecule absorbs the light. So you have different bands or lines, which are all related to a specific vibration.
Yeah.
But then in order to then know what it is, you need to compare it to a calculation of that spectrum. And that's based on a calculation of the structure. Mm-hmm. And then once you know the structure, it's a little bit like a harmonic oscillator. So you can then, from all the bonds in this molecule, you can calculate where it should absorb the light.
Okay.
And then you get, that's often quite good, but not so good. Otherwise, we don't need to do the experiment. But then we can compare, and then we just see, so is it this structure or that one?
Mm.
And so are these features, you know, there or are they not there? And then we can do this. And also then on the chemistry, you want to know the energies of this, if a reaction is actually possible.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, if it is exotherm or endotherm, it's something, chemistry.
Yeah.
So if maybe it's not allowed because you need a lot of energy actually to go from one, from the reactants to the product, and then this might not happen in space where it's very cold.
And with the vibrational energy, you can also distinguish between, So I remember the trans and the cis configuration. Can you distinguish between?
Yes, in the best case. Yes.
Oh wow, that's very impressive. It must be very precise, right? Or is the difference big between?
That depends a lot on the molecule, right? So if you have a very large molecule and only a small change, then depends on the resolution of your laser. So how well you can distinguish. But in the general case, the systems we look at, they are very often different enough so that we can say this. But the larger you go, the more difficult it gets. That's something we learn.
And so when we're talking about the resolution of the laser, are we then talking about the frequency or something else? Because Felix is in the terahertz domain, so infrared. Is that a high enough resolution, or is there...
It is. Yeah, that's also good. Felix is, yes, it's basically from terahertz to infrared, so it's a very broad frequency range that we can cover with Felix. That's what makes it so unique. But it is true that it's not one of the highest resolution lasers, and I really mean frequency. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are, in some regions, you know, tabletop lasers who have a much higher resolution, which are very, very narrow band. Felix is limited because it's a bit complicated maybe to explain, but it's basically limited by the pulses, the length of the pulses it can produce.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And, so it's Fourier limited. Mm-hmm. It's what it's called. So there is a really, a hard limit on how narrow the laser can be, but it is, you know, because we combine it with instruments that are, you know, have called molecules. Mm-hmm. So, it is of the order, let's say, 0.5% of the center wavelength, you want to know. So you cannot see all the details. You could maybe with other lasers, but you can measure the whole range of the vibration spectrum. So you get all the features, and that is, for our purposes, really, and for a lot of the other groups, it's really the main reason we want to use it, because
that
you get the whole the fingerprint region basically of the molecule, and that is something you cannot do with kind of commercial tabletop lasers. So they are always limited to different regions. That is what makes it so special.
Yeah.
Also the power. So we our laser has free electron laser has a lot higher output power, the number of photons. And for a lot of the things you want to do, we need that because we have very dilute samples, and we need to play some tricks actually to break the molecules apart. And for that, you need to have also this power. That is really...
Oh, okay. So that's why you would do... Oh, yeah, I didn't think of the whole laser spectrum that you have to do. But then the resolution is like how precise a peak would be.
Yes.
Okay.
Or how much you can separate two peaks that are close together. Yes.
And that doesn't really come across often, that you really need to look into the piece that's happening, right? I think it's, again, it depends on the use case.
It depends on what you want to do, yes.
And then,
because we always want to have everything, but we already have quite a lot.
And then I also know that at Stanford there's an X-ray field electron laser.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sometimes something maybe that would be useful, that frequency spectrum, or?
It's certainly useful. Certainly a useful ray. I mean, but it's really a very different frequency range. So we are, as you say, terahertz to infrared.
Mm-hmm.
So the rudder, so that's where the molecules have vibrations, mm-hmm. and in the terahertz region also rotation.
Ah, okay.
Which is also interesting, or very very low modes that are not very easily accessible otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you go to the Stanford lasers or the XFEL, this is really in the UV or VUV, XUV region even. So this is where you really address electronic states in a molecule. So that's a bit, it's just a different thing. But of course you can do a lot of great science, and also in the field of astrochemistry with these lasers by, for example, looking at the photochemistry, mm-hmm. so means, for example, if space, very easy example, you have a molecule there and you have a lot of photons from nearby stars. So you might want to know, is this actually dissociated because of these photons, or is it stable? Or if it is dissociated, what kind of fragments do you get?
So is it about the electric states? You mean the energy levels?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So it's way more... you're zooming in way more in, right? It's you're going to a smaller domain, I meant.
So the wavelength is a lot uh-huh. smaller. So when we are at like micrometers, uh-huh. they are at nanometers, or even, I mean, so it's even farther, higher in energy than uh-huh. optical light or visible light. And in this sense, you can really promote an electron from, a shell to a higher shell, or even, you know, kick it out or ionize or dissociate the molecules.
So I think then also with that frequency, you can't really look at too big of molecules, right? Otherwise it will get too complicated.
Or it's people do this. Yeah, you can do it. It depends then what kind of matter you use to detect. I mean, there's a lot of different fields. So there is also, you know, you can do some sort of crystallography on this large species. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can even work in solid state physics with these lasers, right? So I'm more talking now about what is interesting for our field. So, but definitely, also with a synchrotron, if you, this frequency region is also very interesting. But what we do is really, looking at these vibrational modes, and which gives us the direct link to the structure. And that is what we mainly work on.
And then let's look into the tools that you have now at the Felix laser. So one of them is the COL22 ion trap, right?
Yes.
So I'm guessing that cold means very low temperature. But for example, let's start. What is an ion trap in the first place?
An ion trap, it's actually not very difficult to understand. I mean, We have a lot of different instruments here. Many of them are ion traps. The one I work with is actually a cold ion trap, so that's the one difference. But why an ion trap? It's basically we look at ions, so that is charged particles. So you either have, you know, an electron missing, or you have an extra electron.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have these charged particles, they are very easily manipulated by electric or electromagnetic fields.
Yeah.
So we have very nice tools to actually mass filter, for example. So if we somehow make an ion, or many ions typically, then we can use a mass filter and we end up with just a mass of interest, which helps us already a lot because we want to have a nice starting point. So that is the very standard. And then we actually to do the spectroscopy or the chemistry, you would like to, you know, control these these molecules. And this is just a trap. So the ion trap is nothing else than also electric fields. In our case, it's pure electric fields, radio frequency fields. Okay. And if you design them correctly, you can basically then store these ions in one place. So you really can confine them within a few cubic centimeters in place for seconds or even longer. I mean, you can, you know, let them run in, let them run out, all this. And in between, you can do well, your magic, your spectroscopy or your chemistry. And the one thing that is this special about the cold trap that we are running is that it's cold. So basically, the whole trap is just sitting on a big fridge on a helium cryostat, so we can cool it down to down to 4 Kelvin, so to -270 Kelvin, or Celsius, degrees Celsius. Which means then we are actually very close to the temperatures that we also have in space.
Happening in space. Yes. Ah, okay.
And that is not always really needed. I mean, for the spectroscopy, it doesn't matter that much. But for the chemistry, of course, a lot of things can change if you do it at cold temperatures or warmer temperatures, because you have more or less energy.
And that's how you can recreate what is happening in space, but now in a nice lab setting.
Yeah, so we basically mimic the conditions temperature-wise for a lot of the things. And well, the densities are still a little bit higher, I must say, than what we have in space, because otherwise it would just take very long.
So
what happens in space is of the order of, you know, 10,000 or so of years, and we don't want to wait that long.
What is the order here? In a matter of hours, or...?
Well, yes, yeah. I mean, well, for reactions, it's more that we tune it really that a reaction is happening in let's say, a second or so, if everything has happened, so that we can repeat it many times to measure. But of course, if you do experiments, then it's, to get like nice spectra, it usually takes a couple of hours or
2 days. Yeah, it wouldn't make sense to have the same density in space. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get anything done. Yeah.
No, you have to be sure that, you know, the processes are still the same, right? If you're too high, then other processes might take place, like three body collisions, which you don't have in space. But otherwise, it scales, right? So that's the nice thing. So you just speed it up, but it might not be very different.
Ah, it's when you talked about the ion traps, and then it's basically electric field testing. That's that is very electrical engineering. So
yes, that's true.
Yeah,
actually, then most of these is in many labs here, it's also home built. So the one that we have is also where it was built in Cologne. But it's it's really it's a lot of. I can show you later.
Yeah, I'm very excited to take a look at it. And then the only reason that you can use electric fields, of course, and that you can use that it has to be ions, is because it's charged. So, but it would make sense because the parts are charged anyways, because you shoot a laser at it, right? So,
there are also experiments here where you use neutral species, but the thing is just that, I mean, that depends a little bit on how you do your spectroscopy. So, so we often, as I said, often use this so-called action spectroscopy, where we use mass spectrometry, which is very sensitive, so you can count single ions. So you only need, let's say, a few thousand to measure a spectrum. Whereas when you use absorption spectroscopy, by just shining the light and then detecting the light that is absorbed, then you typically need a lot more of these species. So it's getting a little bit more more difficult. So a lot of most of the instruments here are based on this mass spectrometry, because you get the sensitivity and can use this action spectroscopy to learn something.
And so, why is it called the 22 pole?
I guess it has really 22 rods, poles. So, I mean, I don't know if you know a quadrupole, which is often used in standard chemistry or mass spectrometry. That's what we use to mass filter. It has just four of these electrodes that are just pairwise connected then to this radio frequency.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And this was actually invented by Dieter Gerlich's group, and further developed then in Cologne by Stefan Schlemmer, where I was also then, in which group I was. And the reason why you have so many, and not only four, is that, that's also a bit electro again, is that then the potential you create where you actually trap them. So it's like for a quadrupole, it's like this harmonic oscillator. So they sit in there and cannot move. But the more of these electrodes you have, the flatter this potential gets. That means you have a very, kind of flat potential, meaning they don't see much of the field. And then you can cool them better to these low temperatures, because you can cool the trap, right? But you need to cool also the ions in there. So we do that by pulsing in some helium, and that helium collides, and you want to cool them down. And in other potentials, you often have heating, and you just don't reach these low temperatures. So very technical.
Oh,
aspect.
That's very interesting.
It could also be 24 or 20. It's just that is.
But so it wasn't that straightforward to make like the ion trap, but then for cold applications, that's why the 22 is there. It's an important feature.
But the traditional, yes.
That's very impressive. And then okay, so in astrochemistry, you're already saying that 20 new species were found this year.
Last year, yeah.
Oh, last year. Oh,
yeah, we already generated. Yes.
So, what kind of molecules are you mostly interested in right now?
So, the thing is, what we are interested in is really related to what we want to look at, the regions we want to look at. So one big area of research is these so-called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons that I mentioned before, these very large organic molecules just composed of carbon and hydrogen and maybe with some nitrogen incorporated, because they are actually seen everywhere. So the James Webb Telescope will also target some of these areas where you see this in a lot of detail. But there's not much known really how they, still not much known how they really form, especially in this cold regions. So that's something that we also work on. I mean, there are many groups also in the Netherlands working on different aspects. Mm-hmm. So we think with our methods here, we can also provide some very interesting information on all these formation processes. But the thing is, we also, I mean, once you have some of them, you can also think about what happens now if you, for example, fragment them. So they're not nicely, you know, these fused rings anymore, but then you have some dangling side chains or you break them apart. How do you break them apart? Because this might all happen out there in space.
Yeah.
So this is the one part. So we basically break them apart and look what happens, and we grow them and look what happens. So that's the one aspect. But in this, all these fragments, there are also a lot of very much smaller fragments, like just, you know, a couple of atoms. So we work on something like C3H2. So that is really also still very, very little known on a lot of these species, really also from the spectroscopy side, from a very fundamental aspect. So that's then maybe not so much the astro, but it's really then the spectroscopist or physicist that comes out in me, because this is really a lot of quantum effects that are happening and that we can probe. And only probe here, I would say, really with our laser, that with the Felix laser, that you can go down to these low frequencies where you see a lot of very interesting effects happening. So that's a very theoretical work. But also these species might be there, so you need to understand them in order to find them. And then a new project we're starting soon is within our new Max Planck Center that we have with the Fritz Haber Institute, which just started last year, is that we want to look also really at what we call this prebiotic chemistry. So it's really this kind of,
this is not about how life started, right?
Yeah, well, let's say very, very early start. Really, the first steps, for example, you know, if you add something like 2-formaldehyde molecules, do you actually form a sugar, I mean, like a larger species or not?
And this is where the question is how, for example, amino acids.
Or amino acids, that could be another point. So there is also a lot of research done, of course, already. But we have some ideas how to also then look at this from this chemistry side and combine it again with the spectroscopy to really see which kind of things we form. And then, again, under conditions that are similar to molecular cloud. So these are, for me, some of the very interesting pathways. So, I mean, I could give you a long list of names of molecules, but that's maybe not.
So what I'm wondering is, to me, when you talk about the polycyclic structures and then you want to elongate something and see what's happening, can you actually predict it, or is it really a shot in the dark what's happening?
Well, I mean, the hope is that, for example, let's assume you start with something like benzene, which is this one, you know, aromatic ring. You have six hydrocarbons, and then you feed it some carbon units, basically. Yeah. So we use, for example, acetylene, which is just 2 carbons and 2 hydrogens.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, and that has also been seen before in mass spectroscopy or calculated, you can see some that you add these units, right?
Okay.
But what, of course, to go to a polycyclic, what you want is that these add so that they form the next ring. So that two of them actually, and then you have a two-membered, you know, two-cyclic, duocyclic, how is that called actually, ring. Like that naphthalene
in my head,
would be the...
Indeed, it's hard to explain how it actually looks like, because it's not two benzene, it's fused together.
Right? Yeah, yeah, so they're basically, yeah, they're fused at the two positions. But this is then, would be the first then polycyclic, let's say. And this is something that, well, this is what we want to see, but of course, I mean, that's what we run into now. There are a lot of possibilities. So that is where we then need also calculations to actually see what could happen. So what are the structures that might form, and then calculate the spectra compared to what we see in the end.
Ah, okay, I see.
So it's well, you can have some chemical intuition, I guess, but we found a few surprises, so that's why I think the measurements are very worthy to do.
Yeah, so for me, because I don't really have a good chemistry background, it sounds to me like a shot in the dark, you know? Oh, it's interesting that the calculations now help a lot now with the... Are there a lot of possibilities that can happen? And do they also happen in the... 30% is this outcome and 60% is this outcome?
Yeah, that's what we see. So you can have... You can have branching, so to speak, so that you have not only one reaction happening, but different ones. And then experiments get a little bit more complicated. But we also have some methods where we can measure how much we actually form. That is then, by just seeing how much we can actually completely destroy, for example, and then we know the rest must be something else. So there are a few tricks that we develop right now to look into this. Yeah.
And then coming back to Venus, there has been like something. There's this molecule called phosphine, said to be found on Venus, and that could maybe mean there was life on Venus. What is your opinion about it?
I want to be careful there. no, I mean this is. I know when this paper came out, it caused quite a lot of attention. So basically, what these people did was they measured they observed one. That was actually a rotational, so very low frequency, and then sub-terahertz region, basically, of this molecule in the atmosphere using different telescopes.
Yeah.
But there has been a lot of controversy or a lot of discussion now, and just a couple of months ago, there's also another paper coming out that could not reproduce these observations.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting,
okay.
Yeah. So, because it is not, I mean, it's... it's not so easy because you if you have only one, you know, transition, there is a lot of chance that there a much chance that you can have some interlopers, and that's what these other people found, that maybe it's not phosphine but it's SO2, another molecule. So you would normally like to have quite a few of them. The other thing is then they modeled it, and it's really the question if it could also be like some more instrumental effects. Baselines and noise again
noise.
We have before. So it is still debated. So that's I have looked at the papers, and I don't really want to judge who is right, but the other question of course is, let's assume it is there, then is then the link to life actually. Because it could also be that it's not, so the idea was that this phosphine is there because it's produced by or was produced by microbacteria, for example. But the question is that really the only, you know, means to produce it? So there are other people who think that it might have been volcanic activity also that is responsible for this. But on the other hand, I mean, it was a very interesting finding, and I know, I mean, I heard some of these people speak that they did a lot of, you know, scrutinizing the data, but in the end, I mean, you have to publish it and then bring it out there for other scientists to, you know, debate about it. I mean, that's science, right? So you have this and you do the best you think there is, and that is the result, and then you you have to open the discourse on basically the open review of the work. And it would be very interesting indeed. And what I also would like to emphasize, it's of course very important that you think about this kind of, what are the tracers, you know, what would you expect to see in an atmosphere that might point towards life.
Yeah, because for now, the only thing I really know that would point towards life is is if you have liquid H2O, right?
Liquid H2O might help, yes. But, I mean, it's like a prerequisite, I guess, for most of the life as we know it.
Has it been established? No, I'm thinking about it.
There is not much statistics, right, on life, so we only have it here.
Oh, that's
but
very
I now, I mean, I think there is a broad consensus that liquid water is very necessary for life as we know it to exist. So
our
that is definitely true. Oxygen is another one that, you know, is typically you know, associated. If you have oxygen in the atmosphere, that is just here on Earth actually produced then by life. I mean by plants, not.
I think the most clear-cut thing is if you have found amino acids, but that's very tough. But
also, again, there's also, you know, different way to...
Could the prebiotic molecules be used as an indicator for life?
I mean, to some extent, but that is the thing. So if you... There are, you know, non, let's say, or call this abiotic pathways, maybe to form them. I mean, like they formed here on Earth in the beginning, there was no life, but somehow the first amino acids have formed just by chemistry. And then you start to replicate, and then at some point you call it life if it replicates and it has a cell as a unit. So in that sense, if you find just a single amino acid, there's also the question. So
yeah, because it just happened to be by chance that it's made. Yeah, it's also tough to make a claim like that.
Yes, well, but you can argue for it or against it, and that's where everything goes together also, right, with, you know, models, laboratory observations. So you always need all these different aspects to have it.
Oh, exciting. Yeah. Wow. And then I remember the thing is, when I'm thinking about astrochemistry, the best thing that I could remember in my mind is a year ago or something, I read something about phosphine. And yeah, that's why I thought about it, the phosphine molecule, because...
Yeah. It's a two-sided sword. I mean, it's always very good that this kind of...
Of course, the public, you know, picked that molecule and made
it. That can also happen, but it's always good if you have these kind of, you know, big steps or new discoveries, but... If it then turns out not to be true, that it's also not so good for the field. But as I said, I think I would also have published it at the time because they had a model, they had an explanation, and they just, you know, say that is what we think it is, and now do something with it. And if it now turns out it's something else, But there might be I forgot the name now, but a probe to Venus soon, so that could then
that will happen. Oh, that would be very, very helpful.
So that could then maybe give the definitive answer.
Yeah.
So if they have, I think, a millimeter spectrometer or so on board to measure this. And
Yeah. Of course, there cannot be a Mars rover on Venus, but a probe will be good enough, a Venus rover. And then, the conditions are too extreme for
I think that would be tough.
It would be very tough. But yeah, then... when I was looking through your publications, there was a 2014 Nature paper about the H2D+, and that could indicate the age of cloud forming, such as the sun, which was started was 1 million years, but instead it was shorter, like 100,000 years.
The other way around, but yeah.
So there must be... Very exciting, because it's a order of 10 more. So
that's it was a super exciting project. That is true.
How did it start?
How did it start? Actually, I think it predated me being there. It's the thing is. So first of all, it was there was a lot of other people also thinking about this, because so how do you actually date? You know, how do you get to know the age of such a cloud, right?
Yeah.
So you cannot watch it over like a million years. Even 100,000 years. So you need to find some sort of clock, right? You need to find something to measure time within this molecular cloud.
Like C14 dating here.
Like C14 dating here, but on different time scale. And it's what is used in space often is really chemistry. So because you, if you think about a cloud, you know, it starts very diffuse, it starts to then become, you know, denser, and at some point, you know, it starts forming the stars.
Yeah.
And all this time, you know, chemistry is happening. And there was long study before, also by some people on the paper from the group, that this H2D plus molecule, which is actually, well, hydrogen is the most abundant one, and then the, if you stick then another proton to it, you end up with H3 plus. And then this H2D plus is just a deuterium instead of a hydrogen. We need that because we, otherwise we cannot observe it.
Yeah.
That this, the H3 plus is not, you know, it's not observable with the kind of telescopes we had. And then it was, found then also by modeling, by theory, but also by laboratory experiments that, this, well, I need to go one step back, sorry. because this H2D plus is seemingly very simple, but it exists in two different forms. So it's called autopara, which depends on actually nuclear spins, a really very, you know, quantum effect on these two hydrogens. And this is linked then to the most abundant molecule, this H2 also happening, also having an auto and para form. And that was long known, that this autopara ratio and this hydrogen itself is very much linked to how long actually this gas has been, you know, processed or chemically processed in this cloud. So it needs a very long time actually when it's formed somewhere to actually then go to adjust its ratio to the temperature.
Yeah.
And that is what we call kind of a chemical clock.
Uh-huh.
So if you are able to observe then this ratio and then combine it, of course, with a lot of, you know, data analysis and modeling, you can basically then calculate back the time it had been processed before. Mm-hmm. And this is what gives us this clock. And so that what I liked very much about this project was that it was a very large collaboration, and it was actually really how it should be. So involved were, of course, laboratory people, like as found before, my colleagues in Cologne found these frequencies. Then there was a lot of you know, experiments also on this kind of, you know, autopara and calculations. Then we had, of course, real astronomers who knew how to do these observations very well and analyze them. We had modelers these are really people who specialize on trying to model the whole chemistry and also physical structure of these sources and develop this huge kind of in silico networks to try then to reproduce what's happening and compare this to the calculations. So they were involved, but also the technical, the instrumentation team, because this was done with a very cool telescope. I don't know if you know that one. It's called SOFIA. So it's the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, which is actually a Boeing 747, which is flying
so
in the stratosphere.
So you're flying, and then...
You're flying because then you're above the atmosphere, so you have a clearer view,
less
right?
Noise.
Less noise or less absorption from the atmosphere. And that was done also in Cologne, and they were much involved, Cologne and Bonn, in developing this, well, receiver, this kind of part of the telescope that we use then to detect these lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had all the expertise in how to best do this. And so in the end, everyone, you know, was joining in on this project. And that was very satisfying. It was a lot of fun. And we all learned a lot from each other, I think.
You were on the plane, right?
I was also on the plane, yes. Not for this exact measurements, but for some afterwards. And yes,
wow.
It's nice.
That's really cool. I've never heard of like a flying telescope, but it's just generally happening. Wow.
Yeah, well, that's why, I mean, it's difficult sometimes to do it from the ground. Right?
And how long did it take? Because it sounds like it had many phases, right? First, you have, was it all happening in parallel? Like, the modelers were working on
it? Oh, yeah, some of it. But yeah, in the end, is from the first idea that, my then, supervisor, Stefan Schlemmer had, I think, in Cologne to then, really having the final results. That took several years, of course.
Wow.
But then, you know, for telescopes, you write a proposal, you get the time, and then we had the data, and then, but a lot of the underlying theory or models was already also there. But then, of course, it needed to be adapted. And so, yeah, it took a little bit of time.
So, like, that is what is called a measurement campaign, right? When you go on the telescope, for example, and you start...
Or observational campaign.
Observational
mm-hmm.
campaign. So, if you were to do a measurement campaign in Felix, are there, like, you can't just ask and they start off the laser, right? They're operations.
You mean if we go downstairs now and maybe they are nice? No. What means no? I mean, this is. No, we are a little bit in that sense similar to telescopes. So the Philips Laboratory and also the HFML, so the High Field Magnetic Laboratory. So we are one unit. We're both based on proposals, so project based or proposal based projects, and we have so two calls for these proposals per year. And so we also ourselves, so we have a few quite a few internal groups, like ours, where we do the research, but we also have to write the proposals. But we also, of course, are a user facility. That means the laser, but also most of our instruments are available to external researchers. So people can apply for time here, they write this proposal, and then there is an external committee, program advisory committee, who actually then judges this proposal for the scientific merit. And then you will be granted so and so many nights or days on the laser. So that's how this in general works. And then these are scheduled then really well in advance. So for half a year, there will then be a very fixed normally.
So the people can prepare really well for that.
Yeah, so this is usually
the only three nights or something that you have, right?
No, that is, yeah. It often doesn't work in just one night. No, the thing is that we're often, of course, already involved and also in during the proposal writing. So there's discussions, and of course, if the external researchers know the facility very well, it can be very independent, but often it's also in collaboration, and you discuss together and you brainstorm together on how to do then actually the experiment and how much time is needed, what kind of, you know, preparations are needed for this, what needs to be changed. So there is a lot of interaction, a lot of goes into collaboration, but it's really, there's a lot of support also, not only let's say for me or from the other PIs here, but we also involve our PhD students in these guest projects, which I usually find very interesting, because you know you learn other topics and and often then also, you know, further collaborations or you pick up things or then you work together on something else. That's what we all find very rewarding. It's of course a little bit of extra work, but it's very rewarding. And the same is true then for our project. So we need a lot of, you know, planning before. So it's not like you can go to the lab and if something doesn't work, then you do it the next day, but we need to be ready when the laser is there. So yes.
You can't just suddenly start up with the electron laser. That is true.
Well, it's typically running most of the time. So but it's then distributed. So we have there are different lasers at the Philips Laboratory. So there are four in total. Some of them can run in parallel. And some are need to be exchanged, but so typically there are two shifts per day. So like the morning for 8 hours and then in the evening. We don't run at night.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Some people do not. So basically you get then one of these, we call it then shifts, and you can have two in a row or something like this. But the laser is then, but it needs to be of course optimized. So we have a very great technical team, of course, so we don't really do this ourselves. Sometimes a bit helping, but it's not. So they really, you know, they maintain the whole laser, so that's why we have a very large technical team, and they were very skilled. And they then provide basically the light that we then use.
Yeah, that's really for amazing. Experiments. Yeah, that reminds me of CERN. I feel like the technical team is bigger, the group of technical team is bigger than the people that actually use the laser.
that can be. Yeah, but at CERN is of course also.
CERN is very bigger, of course.
Yes.
To close the podcast, I'm always looking for book recommendations because I love reading. So, which book or author would you say has been the big influence in your life? that you really enjoyed, for example?
I actually read very much, so it's very hard for me to answer that, I must say. I have to confess that I mostly read novels. So I have some phases where I read also textbooks or other books, but let me think. So from the we have two things. So I have one book that it's a quite old book. Mm-hmm. It's actually called The Physicist.
From
Friedrich Dürrenmatt, maybe you know it already. It's actually a theater play, and this was quite influential. Not really, well, on decision or so what to do, uh-huh. but it's about three physicists who are, one of them actually has discovered, you know, the world formula, let's uh-huh. say, and but he then feels all this responsibility because uh-huh. people could just, you know, misuse it, and yeah. then, you know, he becomes mad and. Then other people try to steal this from him, and they become, because they all decide actually to not do it.
Uh-huh.
So it's basically about what responsibility you have as a scientist uh-huh. in general about what you find out. Uh-huh. So for society, yeah, for peace, for uh-huh. politics, and I found this. I mean, I read this long time ago, but it's a very satirical playbook. So it's funny, uh-huh. kind of, but you know, it's like one of these. Oof, so you stop mm-hmm. laughing in the middle of it because you realize, yeah,
you really messed up.
It's really a big question, uh-huh. right? So who is to decide? So I found this at the uh-huh. time very, well, it's still something, you know, that sticks. That, yeah. that you, of course, when we do astrophysics research, you often don't come into this
But it really problem, reminds me of the, for example, the carbon nanotubes technology. It has really good potential, but also you can use it as a war weapon. So yeah, you really hope that it's only going to be used for the
for a good purpose. So that's yeah. something I like. But otherwise, at the moment, I'm actually trying to read a lot of books in Dutch because
oh,
I
really?
Need to practice my uh-huh. Dutch. So I very recently really started to read. There's this very talented young writer in the Netherlands. I hope I say the name right, Marieke Lucas Reineveld.
Yeah, you did. I don't know. Yeah. Correctly.
and he actually, yeah, he won the Booker Prize recently. It's a very small book. It's the avond is ongemaakt. So I think mm-hmm. What is the translation? Something with
the avond is ongemaakt.
Yeah.
The night is done.
No, yeah, it is maybe somewhere I have it. I think I wrote it down because I could not remember the discomfort of evening.
The discomfort of evening.
Yeah, so it's a bit more, and it's a very tough book. So it's about, you know, it's about loss and coming of age and abuse and all this. But I really like this writing style, and now for Christmas I got the next book by him of which is
that's very nice.
And I'm really looking uh-huh. forward to that. So that's something mm-hmm. to keep me a little bit you know, to switch off mm-hmm. after work. And
I enjoy reading novels as well instead of textbooks and stuff, because that's what we do all day. So we need something to switch off our minds and think
yeah.
about other topics.
I mean, sometimes if it's a kind of combination, that mm-hmm. can also be nice, but But it's so if then I often then not really read physics textbooks, mm. although maybe I should to keep up, but also then from other fields, like about neuroscience or these kind of things. So that's also interesting. So then I'm really the layman laywoman who just reads those.
I think a book that I really like is called The Three Body Problem.
Yeah.
It is something that it could happen right now, but it hasn't yet. But it is talking, for example, about the three body problem hasn't been solved, right? But what happens if it is solved? How would it happen? And it's a science fiction book. And it's very fundamental physics based. Like, it's talking about particle accelerators is one of the topics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I should put it on my list then.
it's really good. I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, that reminds me. That was one of the first books that got me into science fiction at that moment. Yeah, it was really cool. So thank you for joining the podcast. I really
thanks for asking.
Episode.
All the interesting questions. We can continue also afterwards.
This is so cool. Yeah, I really am curious to see the Phoenix Laboratory. But yeah, thank you for listening, audience. And then
thank you. Yes.
Thank you.